Hello and what is up, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we are getting into the generational divide today. This is a topic that comes up every 12 to 15 years or so in regards to where the wine industry is headed. This is something that we touched upon in an earlier episode of kind of how these generational shifts happen. And we're going to just talk shop about why, personally, I don't think it's nearly as big of a deal as people are making it out to be. There are a lot of wine businesses, a lot of wine professionals kind of shaking in their boots right now. Not without a good reason, but there are a lot of questions that they're asking, and I feel like some of those are misguided. So we're going to talk about a lot of that today. Before we get into it, as usual, thank you everybody for continuing to download and consume the podcast here. Please, for everyone who hasn't had a chance, be sure to rate and review the show to give it a little bit more reach and a little bit more of a broader audience. Please keep sharing it with your wine-loving friends and family. That is always a huge help. You can follow us for regular updates, more day-to-day seller operations, and kind of what actually happens behind the scenes in a wine business. On any of our social networks that we're on, we're pretty much on everything except TikTok, so that's the book of face. Social network formerly known as Twitter. Instagram and YouTube are probably the most active accounts where you can find regular updates of kind of what's going on day to day. It'll be at MTGA Wines on all of those. The YouTube channel is also where you can find stuff like tasting notes, the video version of this podcast. So if you want to see me dance around my home studio, that'll be the place to do it. All right, without further ado, the conversation we're talking about today, the generational divide. This is something that happens every time a new generation is about to start getting into its years of alcohol consumption, you know, when you're in your early 20s or thereabouts, right? And we're talking about you Gen Z folks that might be out there listening. I know we probably have a lot more millennial, Generation X, and a couple of boomer generational folks out there, myself being in that millennial cohort. And this is a conversation that comes up every time this kind of generational shift happens. Now, the reason the wine industry is kind of shaking in their boots are a couple of things. Let's go ahead and lay that framework out first and foremost, because that will give you a little bit of perspective on kind of what questions are being asked, how wineries are adapting, and how realistically the alcohol industry is adapting as well. I completely lost my train of thought. How about that? Man, I was on such a good roll to get started. Oh. All right. Let me go ahead and try this again. 3, 2, 1. Let's go ahead and lay out kind of where these issues are stemming from and what the alcohol industry and wineries in particular are taking into consideration. Number one, first and foremost, is that as it stands right now, the younger generation is consuming less wine than prior generations. It's not a huge surprise. We'll get into why that is here in a couple of moments. But that is the truth, is that there are less people in the younger generations currently consuming high-end wines. I say high-end wines for a specific reason. That should make a lot of sense. And if for some reason it doesn't, don't you worry, we'll spell it out for you. Number two, you have the legalization. Legalization of weed, cannabis, Mary Jane, the devil's lettuce, whatever you want to call it. There are now more states that offer that as an alternative for folks. And there are many folks that enjoy just their little nighttime gummy as a sleep aid. There are plenty of folks that love to get baked and watch Super Troopers. Hey, to each their own, whatever you want to do. And there's a theory that there's this trend towards what we lovingly call in our state, and I think probably other states actually did this for us. I don't think we, the state of California, can take credit for this. But we call it California sober, where, yeah, maybe we enjoy alcohol here there, but maybe it's a drink or so every once in a while. But weed is where we hang our hat. That is certainly not where I hang my hat, but there are plenty of folks that do that. So California sober is apparently a thing, which is kind of hilarious to me, realistically. I feel like that's more of a Pacific Northwest vibe, but whatever, you know, see each their own. Number three is that there are just this large swath of this generation, new generation coming into play, that aren't interested in those things. They're not interested in alcohol. They're not interested in the weed. They see them as detrimental to life and they want to avoid them wholeheartedly. They're much more health conscious. Sure, why not? There is always going to be that segment of the population. Has it spread? Has it grown? Number four, and frankly, I think the biggest issue is just the fact that it's a smaller generation. It's a smaller pool of people that we are pulling from. And number five, quite honestly, the fact that, you know, beer and alcohol, beer and liquor still outweigh the wine industry pretty much without even trying, that has always been a huge issue. That is the one kind of consistent one that's the elephant in the room, in my opinion, right up against the generational size or just the population base we're working off of. Those last two, realistically for me, are the most important. Everything else kind of falls by the wayside because this is all shit we've seen before. When I got started in marketing and wine, this would have been, 2012, 13. So we're going about 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And this was the same conversation we were having about my generation, the millennials. We were getting into our mid-20s. There are still a large swath of us that are, you know, not even teenagers yet. Hell, the Generation Z, I think, like the end of that generation is like 2012. So some of them are like just barely teenagers yet. So you have a very young cohort of people that realistically, unless their parents are really into fine wine, they're probably not going to be. To kind of exacerbate that a little bit, most of these folks, like many of us, and we've all been here in our early and mid-20s, haven't exactly hit our earning potential. We simply do not have the disposable income and in that age range that you have from folks that are 10 years their senior, 20 years their senior, right? So when folks are kind of worried about, hey, why isn't the young generation drinking wine yet? It's because they can't fucking afford it, silly. Like, what are we talking about here? You serious? Were you drinking like top-notch Napa Cab at 22? I mean, some of us were, but there are always exceptions that prove the rule. You know, there has to be those. It's really a non-issue. Am I worried about Generation Z not getting into wine? Not particularly. Because people in that age range typically aren't. They haven't been put in a position where it makes sense to integrate it into their lives. They can't afford to integrate it into their lives. And they don't have the jobs where they're wining and dining and entertaining, where having some sort of basic knowledge on wine sort of becomes something you need to have. There is a long way to go before any of that really comes along. We're talking at least another 5 years or so when they start to have a little bit more steady jobs, when they start to have a little bit more disposable income, and they have the ability to travel, to eat, to drink, and move along. Realistically, I'm not worried about that. So that I kind of dismiss, to be quite honest. Now, the California sober thing and the just abstaining from alcohol in general, based on, you know, reports I've heard from the Napa Valley Vintners, based on just a basic search online of Gen Z kind of habits and their use of cannabis or alcohol, none of that seems to really pan out. Now, it could, theoretically. I mean, there's still a long ways to go before these folks get into that, you know, buying age range where they have that consumer power that the prior generations currently have. And that might shift. That might change. But that is yet to be seen. And the way studies are looking at this is that realistically, those that are utilizing weed and don't want to use alcohol, the same people are just going about that. The proportions are within a margin of error. The folks that aren't drinking are currently within that same kind of margin of error. You have, in essence, the same statistics. Those that use both, you know, alcohol and weed are still doing that in the same proportions that they normally would. And then, of course, you have the folks that are actually into alcohol, you know, and consuming wine or other alcoholic beverages are still doing that as well. It's really just kind of on this equal, you know, little bit of bumps and, you know, peaks and valleys in the road here or there, but it's not this immense drop off that we're, I think, experiencing in terms of, you know, average consumption per person, right? It's kind of staying the same, which leads me into point number four and the generational divide and kind of what we're seeing between what certain products mean to certain people within a generation, and then realistically, how many of those people are actually interested. I mean, keep in mind, let's do a little research here. Let's do this live, shall we? I probably should have done this ahead of time, but you know what? I'm feeling it. Let's do this. Let's see. Generation by generation. So this is just going to be a quick thing. In the United States, and this is as of 2022. Actually, Gen X isn't even on here. Can we go? Can we dig further into this? Oh, this is just population distribution as of 2022. So Gen Z right now is basically right about the same level as the baby boomer generation. So if you're taking up, you know, call it 20% or so of the overall population, you know, there's something to be said for that. That being said, there are way more boomers born than there were Generation Z. I think we can pretty much stick to that. You'll see Generation X is relatively smaller, only by about a percent or so, give or take, you know, making up less than 20% of the overall population. And then you have the millennial generation right now kind of being the biggest, because you have a lot of us haven't crossed the rainbow bridge just yet, realistically. So it seems like it's a pretty even spread, you know, and there are other studies where it's like, all right, now more than half Americans are millennials or Gen Z. So you have kind of the two younger generations making up the majority of the overall population, right? So if you have these younger generations making up most of the population, as some of those reports will say, based on a very rough and quick Google search we just did together, wouldn't it make sense that you're going to see a little dip in the wine business as some more of these folks start getting into wine, as they start getting to their earning potential and making more money and being able to afford some of the finer things in life? Sure, that makes sense. The same thing happened roughly 10 years ago, and it's really not that surprising. I think the bigger issue is just the overall size of the population when it comes to one generation to the next. Because realistically, if we're still relying on Generation X, your elder millennials, and your baby boomers to do most of the purchasing, you have a significant swath of the population buying, you know, almost all the wine. And if that population base is going to shrink over the next few years, all of a sudden, you're going to have to see a pretty rapid increase in overall wine purchasing and per capita consumption to make up for that population difference. I don't think that's too hard to figure out, right? So when you see these trends kind of coming down the pipeline, kind of where generations are, who's drinking what, who's abstaining, the question for me becomes not, are these folks eventually going to get into wine? Because they already kind of are. They're tiptoeing into it. They're having to ease into it like every other generation before them. It's not surprising. It's not scary. Is business a little slow right now? Sure, but we got to wait for these folks to get where we want them to be, right? You can't just shove a product down someone's throat. You're going to have to wait until they are actually interested and want to enjoy it. That's the way it is. I think the bigger opportunity, and I think where most marketers within the wine industry are kind of missing the boat, is that it's not, hey, can we capture, you know, interest from Generation Z? Because you're going to, just like you did with the millennials, just like you did with Gen X, and so on and so forth. What you're doing right now is you're catering to these groups the same way you always have. And this is one of my biggest pet peeves about the wine industry, that we are historically slow on the uptake of broad market trends, technology, so on and so forth. And it's a very old school industry. It's a very artistic industry. There's a lot of, you know, prestige and historical record and kind of how things have been done over the course of millennia when it comes to producing wine. So there's a mentality of like, hey, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? That really tends to be the way the wine industry kind of goes. They don't really... We kind of get to be sticks in the mud. I'll admit that. We certainly can be sticks in the mud when it comes to this kind of stuff. And we tend to focus on the wrong things when a trend like this comes around. because the same thing happened with millennials. It was like, all right, how do we market to them? How do we make this interesting? How do we capture this market? Because realistically, and this is, excuse me, a little anecdotal, but the way, as you have conversations with people all over the country, like we get to do, whether they're visiting Napa or we're on the road doing events and things, it's, we love to ask, how'd you get into wine? And you know, the answer I hear more often than not, it's, oh, my parents drink wine. We had wine at home, or his parents drink wine. They're like, you know, the father or mother-in-law drinks wine, and we have a glass every once in a while. It's like, it's, and we liked it, so we wanted to learn more about it. There's kind of this gateway that has to be opened for these folks, and it's typically just through grassroots exposure. You know, people of a young generation don't wake up one day necessarily and be like, you know what, let's go to Napa and see what wine's all about. There has to be some sort of experience, you know, preceding that, that's like, hey, wine's interesting. Let's go. We like to enjoy it. We'd love to know more about it. Therefore, let's go and check it out and see what's going on. That door kind of, it's not that it's locked, but it needs to be opened for the new generation before they can walk through it. That's kind of typically how it is. And the question I think that needs to be asked is, why can't we just prop that door open? What is it holding people back from getting into wine? Is it sheerly price point? Is wine just too expensive than that 30 rack a light beer that you can get in the grocery store? Is it just simply more bang for your buck to go to Costco and get that handle of cheap Kirkland brand liquor that you can enjoy for a few weeks or months, right? Is wine just price point wise? Are we, you know, pricing people out? I think that is certainly something that could be true. That is, I think, a huge factor, especially when it comes to wines from Napa. Our wines aren't cheap. It's expensive to be in this business. It's expensive to make these wines. They're expensive. You know, considering that the vast majority of people buy wines that I think are, last time I checked, are like $40 or less, those of us that enjoy high-end wines that kind of go above that, we're the minority. That's the reality. The vast majority of wines that are sold are under $40. That's the way it is. It's probably even a lower price point than that. You could probably even back that off to like $30, most likely, maybe $35. So price point definitely has something to do with it, right? But I think that's not the only thing, because all of us have been in that kind of penny pinching mode. There have been plenty of years I've lived off of Kraft mac and cheese and, you know, cups of noodles. Not my favorite time, but hey, we got through it. Here we are. We've lived, you know, some of us like myself have lived in what we call, you know, Section 8 housing in California, which is low income housing. You know, if you're making, I think at the time for me, it was like, if you're making less than 26K a year, you could apply for it. And that's the reason why I got to live there, is because I was making nothing, especially for trying to live in California, affording to live here. It was wild. So there is just like that price point, like barrier, like you're like, all right, obviously I can't jump over that hurdle yet. I hope to get there someday. So let's wait until that day, right? Kind of going back to like, just let them grow up, let them get steady, let them build their lives and their careers. And eventually wine will be a part of it. It's a natural part of it, especially as they get introduced to it naturally, just through family or business dealings or whatever the case may be. That's kind of the way it's normally gone. That's kind of like the diesel engine of this trend. It just kind of moves forward and eventually people get into it, right? It's kind of tried and true. But I think it even goes one step further, where it's, you can't just sit around and wait, right? I talked about like, how do we prop this door open and make wine more approachable to people? How do we capture the hearts and minds of folks that are drinking seltzers, that are drinking hard liquor, that are drinking, you know, cheap beer, whatever, even craft beer that's a little bit more expensive? Like, how do we start to kind of eat away at the market share that some of these other alcohol industries have? Because wine, it has this invisible barrier. It's like there's a glass ceiling right there. And if you're going to get into it, you have to, there's like this weird pressure. There's this weird like intimidation tactic that wine has of like, oh, if you don't know enough about it, you clearly can't enjoy it the way that wine professionals enjoy it. That, you know, people who are knowledgeable about wine clearly enjoy it more than people that aren't knowledgeable. There seems to be this like locked gate that's in the way of that door. And it's being propped up by a bunch of, you know, pundits and critics who continue to try and instill people that you need their professional opinion to be able to enjoy wine. This is one of my big pet peeves with wine writers, reviewers, you know, critics, is that you're not doing anything to make wine more approachable. You're not necessarily doing anything to enhance people's opinion of wine. What you're doing is posturizing, and you're wafting through these, you know, very romantic flavors and styles and hillsides, and you're saying, oh, this is such a lovely vintage. We're so thrilled to be trying this blah, blah, blah from the hills of na-na-na, and the flavors and aromas intermingle so beautifully with blah, blah, blah. And you're like, all right, cool. What, that's not relatable. That's not relatable. Like, you expect, you know, a younger generation, which is trending towards, you know, really giving a shit about what they're putting in their bodies, what they're consuming, not just from an information perspective, but from, you know, food and beverage as a whole. They want more authenticity. And I think many people are looking for that more and more as years have gone on. They're looking for just authenticity and honesty. You can't just sit there at a fancy white table, you know, white linened table with 8 glasses in front of you and wax poetically about whatever glass of wine's in front of you. That's not relatable. You know, some of us wine geeks might love it. I fucking hate it, but some people love it because they love to nerd out about the little details. Rob, I don't know if you're listening out in Pittsburgh area. I love the fact that you asked about, you know, rootstocks and clonal selections and understanding what is actually going on in our vineyards. You are a true wine geek and I love you for it. You are the 0.01% of wine consumers. You are someone that I will love to talk to for years to come, but that is not the majority of people. And I love geeking out with folks about those kind of nerdy little details about what actually makes a wine tick and how it goes from grape to bottle, from a field into a wine cooler like the one behind me. That's the kind of stuff I love geeking out about. But that's not relatable to the overwhelming majority of people that are trying to learn about wine. That's, to me, that's the gate that needs to be just kicked down. We need to melt that thing down and just get rid of it. We need to prop that door open and let folks know, hey, these folks are quote-unquote wine experts. They might know more about wine than you do. They might know about more about the production than you do. They might have tasted thousands of more wines, hundreds of more wines than you ever have or will. That doesn't matter when it comes to whether or not you enjoy a wine. Just because a wine is $100 or got 100 points or is $5 and got 82 points, that's not going to increase your overall enjoyment of that wine. It might be an interesting anecdote in why you love it. Shoot, there's a bottle of Chocolina, I think at Trader Joe's, maybe it's Whole Foods. It must be Whole Foods. That's like $7 or $8. It ain't fancy. It's not exciting, but you know what? When it's 100 degrees outside and I want a bottle or just a killer glass of white wine while I'm hanging out by the pool, that's a great bottle of wine. That is a great bottle of wine, right? There are plenty of times when we're going out to a nice dinner and you're like, you know what? Actually, this happened last night. Brittany and I went out on a little date night. I'm wearing the same shirt I was last night. Don't judge me. My Drink Local shirt. We both sit down at the bar up at Brasswood, just north of St. Helena a little ways. She orders a glass of white wine. I'm going to completely forget. His name's Chris. I was going to give him a shout out. Now I'm completely spacing on his name. Anyway, she orders a glass of his white wine because we want to support a friend. I order a glass of Picayune because I'm like, oh yeah, I've met them. They're nice folks. I want to support them. And it's like, yeah, just order what, just like, it's easy. You don't need necessarily that personal recommendation from, you know, I say personal recommendation with like air quotes around it, from a critic or a reviewer or whomever. But it's like, oh, I know these people. We've met them. We've spent time with them. They're good folks. Let's buy the wine. that seems to be more and more the trend and what is more and more important to people, at least in my experience and traveling around the country and talking with thousands of people every year and interacting with them about how do I get into wine? How do I understand what's good on a shelf versus bad on a shelf? What do I need to do to get better at drinking wine? It's like, you don't need to get better at drinking wine. You need to simply ask some of the right questions and understand where your wine's coming from. It's easier to rationalize, I mean, because I'm this way, it's easier to rationalize a purchase when there's a face behind it that I know, that I have a relationship with that brand or that item in some way, shape, or form. You know, I buy that $8 or so bottle of Chocolina when I don't give a shit, right? It's my Tuesday night pizza wine, by the pool wine, whatever. Doesn't matter. I just want it to be cold and refreshing. And there are plenty of wines that we own that are of that vibe. We just want it to be good. We don't care about anything else other than it tastes yummy. That's what matters. And it feels like to me that the overwhelming majority of the wine industry still feels as though that's not good enough. Even though that's what we tell each other all the time. That's what we talk about all the time. We still market wine the same way that it's been marketed to people for generations. And we keep that gate firmly in place, letting people know, hey, on the other side of this is how you enjoy wine. Before you get through this gate, you need to like prove to us that you can enjoy wine the way that it is quote unquote meant to be enjoyed. I'm here to say, who gives a shit how you enjoy wine? We need to make it more approachable. We need to make it more interesting. We need to make it more authentic. Because that's what wine is about. That's what it is at its core. Right? Like, that's how you capture people in terms of their interest and their intrigue. You don't put up a fence and say, hey, we know you want what's on the other side of this fence. You got to prove yourself first. The old school like allocation method of wine marketing, and it works to a certain extent. I'm curious to see how it works into the future, given, you know, when high-end, and this bugs the shit out of me, is when really high-end wineries are like, yeah, you can sign up for our mailing list and our allocation, and if you're lucky, you'll be able to purchase. No, you can't meet the winemaker. No, you can't meet the owner. No, you can't visit the property. You just have the privilege of buying our wine. You know, continuing that just like elitist nonsense that, it's just, brother, it's gross, man. It's just gross. Those are the things that I think are in the way of a new generation. Now, whether it's Generation Z, the millennials, my generation, or generations prior, there seems to be this, again, that kind of that gate just in the way of what should just be an open door. Like, come on in. The water's warm. It's nice. Learn a thing or two. On this last trip, I was back in the Midwest for the third time in about a month. It was a hot like 36 hours that I was there, but it was a lot of fun. And there's a gal in the group who was doing the tasting with us by the name of Amy. Amy, shout out to you, asking some just awesome questions through this tasting. And I think what I'm going to paraphrase here, I'm probably going to screw it up. So I'll say I'm going to paraphrase it. But she asked, you know, in essence, like when I walk into a wine shop, and we get this question a lot, by the way, you know, when I walk into a wine shop or a restaurant, like how do I know what's good, bad? Like how do I know how much like sugar's in a wine or how many additives are being used and so on and so forth? Like, what am I missing? Like, how this information doesn't seem readily available. Is there like a trick of the trade to discerning that and making an educated decision on what wine to buy? And this is number 6 on my list. And I save this one for last because this is part of that kind of like elitist mentality, I think, that's total bullshit in the wine industry, is that wineries don't feel the need or the responsibility to let you, the consumer, know what's actually going into your wine that you're consuming. That there is specifically, again, a gate and a barrier between you and the information that you want. And realistically, they're probably not going to unlock that gate for you. They're just not. Because legally, they don't have to. And they can just say, oh, well, you know, we harvest our wine from, you know, ultra premium, mega exclusive, you know, vineyards out in Napa. They are gently harvested by hand, hand sorted through. Maybe we use an optical sorter because we have Boku bucks and we're fancy. From there, the must is gently caressed and placed in stainless steel tanks where it's fermented for days or weeks, where it is gently drained into brand new French oak barrique and aged for months to come until our glorious winemaking team deems it worthy of bottling. At which time you're welcome to enjoy it at your leisure. Never mind the dimethyl dicarbonate, the enzymes, the sulfites, the what else could we use? Mega purple, the tannin powder that we added, the oak chips because those oak barrels didn't quite do what we wanted to do. Ignore all that. But, you know, this is a very high quality wine. You should definitely drink it. Finding that kind of information out is just impossible. And a winery is not going to tell you. They're not going to tell you that they use, you know, tannin powder to add structure to their wine because they're just not. They're not going to tell you that they add mega purple to your wine to, you know, darken it up and add a little bit of sugar. They're not going to do that. They're not going to tell you that they, you know, use certain fining agents or enzymes because they're just not going to do that. Legally, they don't have to. And we got in pretty deep with this question after Amy asked it. And I really hammered home. I probably scared some people in the room because I very similarly listed off a bunch of random things that we can utilize or that we have access to use as winemakers. Because we don't use any of that shit. Absolutely not. But there are plenty of people that do, whether they're big or small. And I tried to hammer it home for people. And I go a little hard into the paint on this issue, and many of you who have been listening to this show for a while know why, but I'll reiterate it, is because now more than ever, when it comes to wine and this beverage that is meant to be what it is, this romantic thing that is enjoyed with friends and family, just on the patio, during dinner, you know, on vacation, it matters so much that you get to know the winery, the winemaker, the producer, and how they're actually producing their wine. Full stop. That is the A number one most important thing, and probably the because it's the biggest challenge for consumers to figure out. You know, the vast majority of you listening to this probably have no idea how I make my wine. At a glance, there's some of you who have been club members for a while that have been purchasing our wines for a while. We've sat down, we've done events, we've hosted you in this cave. You know, you probably know a little bit more than most. There are some of you that have probably never done any of that. And you're like, shoot, well, this is all great information. Like, how can I actually get access to some of this to know what wineries are actually doing? And the answer is you can't unless you ask those questions. Asking those questions are what is going to hopefully give you the information you need to make an educated decision on what wines to buy. That being said, there are going to be a lot of dead ends that you run into. I mean, this is why we are putting a QR code on the back of all of our wines moving forward that links to a website that tells you every last single detail about our winemaking, what methods we use, what substances, everything from yeast and sulfites and what those are. We talk about what sugar-free actually means in the scope of like FDA regulations. We really get to a geeky granular level because we want to try and provide that information to people and make wine more honest and upfront and accessible. We're trying to say, hey, here's the information you want. Come get it. It's sitting right here for you to enjoy. You want to stop alienating people because you think you know better than they do. Because you don't think they need the information that you have. That's that is what is, I think, creating these divides, not just for this new young generation that we've been talking about, but for generations before it as well. That's the reality. This is something that needs to go away, and we need to make it more accessible so that wine is treated more like a cold beer at the end of a hot day of yard work. So that wine is created more like that vodka soda, you know, that you're ordering, you know, to hang out on the back patio of your favorite restaurant. We need to make it more approachable. We need to make it more open and honest and upfront if we really want to compete in this world of alcohol production. Because beer is doing it just fine. They list, outside of their exact recipe of how it's brewed, they say, hey, here's what's in here. You know, hard liquor and distillation is a little bit, I don't know, I really am not super familiar with the, I know what the process is. But, you know, there are plenty of like flavored liqueurs and things. You're like, whew, I wonder what's going on in there. Like that marshmallow flavored vodka has got to be kind of wild. But it seems pretty simple, right? Where you, it's like, oh, you have this high proof spirit and you're extracting certain things from certain materials and it's naturally just in there. Okay, cool. Well, that makes sense. It seems like for whatever reason, beer and liquor in general have kind of captured that. Like it's so easy. Like, you know what vodka is. It's distilled, you know, corn, wheat, potatoes, whatever you got, you know. Shoot, you can make vodka out of anything. I'm pretty sure. You know, gin, you have all these nice, lovely botanicals. I'm a big gin guy, so I love them. Love them. Whiskey, here, insert your barrel age spirits for X amount of time, whatever it is here, but they're very detailed about their process and how they go about certain things and why they do certain things, because that gives them a leg up on their competition. Hey, they don't do that, we do. Like, how do you think, like, the craft beer revolution happened? Do you think that just was an accident? Do you think that wasn't, hey, we have all these big breweries that are just manufacturing mass quantities. Do you think we could actually share like how beer is made and do it more small batch and higher quality and really kind of, you know, give people access to how we do things and why we do things and what makes us unique and special compared to everyone else who's out there? You telling me that craft beer revolution didn't work? That's what wine is waiting for. And that's what this generational divide, that's why this generational divide, you know, needs to stop, you know. The path has already been built. There have been industries that have already achieved this for the wine industry. It's time that we stop worrying about this generational divide in the wine industry and we start focusing on what makes us unique and interesting and special to people and highlighting that while also providing them the information they need to be able to enjoy wine at their leisure without feeling like they need a fucking sommelier certification to be able to enjoy it. That's the reality. I tell you what, it is going to be an interesting couple of years. There are a lot of people that are worried about this issue. There's a lot of people like myself who are like, we'll see what happens. It's going to shake out in an interesting way. Very typically, when you go through these rocky periods economically in an industry like ours, there are going to be a lot of brands that just roll up shop. Shoot, we're already looking at the summer like, yeah, it's going to be a little tight this year. Yeah, we're going to have to kind of pinch our pennies a little bit, be really frugal and make sure that we operate appropriately. We can't just keep doing the same shit that we've always been doing. We got to find ways to be creative and bring people into the fold in ways that we probably haven't done before. And I think this tearing down of the gates and making wine more accessible is the way to do it. That's why we're basically putting all of our eggs in one basket when it comes to that. Because honestly, it's worked like a charm so far. And hell, if no one else is going to do it, hey, someone might as well at least throw it at the wall to see if it sticks. Well, I appreciate you all tuning in to this episode. This generational conversation, it's nothing new. This is probably something that many of you aren't even aware of necessarily, but this is some of like the inner rumblings of what is going on conversationally within the industry and how we are evolving as a new generation comes into kind of buying potential, not buying power, buying potential. Because they don't have the power yet, but they're working towards it because that's what happens generation after generation after generation. And it is figuring out how to make your product, whatever it is, could be wine, could be anything, but how do you make your product interesting, relatable, and in demand with that new cohort of people? That's what you need to be focused on. You can't be focused on the bad stuff. Hey, they're not buying enough wine yet. Yeah, no shit. They can't afford it. That's not news. What are you going to do when they, I mean, what are you doing now to set the tone for them that when they can buy wine and they're interested in wine, how are you getting them into the fold? How are you setting a tone and trying to make it approachable and easy for them to access? Those are the questions that need to be asked. Not what are we going to do if cannabis continues to be legalized around the country? That's not the issue. That's not the issue. It's a red herring issue. What are you going to do to stay relevant with a new generation is the issue. And for those that aren't focused on that just yet, you are going to be hurting in a couple of years. Because if you're already struggling now, it's only a matter of time before this struggle comes right back around and punches you in the face. All right. Have a good one, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. We will be back next week with another episode. Appreciate you all again for liking, subscribing, sharing the podcast with friends. Hopefully you learned something. Something I haven't mentioned in the last couple of podcasts, on Wednesday, May 29th, we are going to be doing our Q&A episode. Be sure that if you have any burning questions about wine, wine industry stuff, growing, farming, winemaking, anything involved in wine, we are happy to address. We try and answer at least 4 or 5 questions at the end of every month. I kind of just have a running list going, keeping track of what we've been talking about on the road during tastings and also questions that are submitted. You can slide into any of our DMs on our social networks. That's at MTGA Wines. You can also go to our website, mtgawines.com. If you scroll down towards the bottom, you can find a little email form. You can kick it old school and send us an email with the question that you have, and we'll try and feature it on the show. Appreciate you all for tuning in. Love you all so much. We'll see you next week.